Let's go.
You're listening to Making Data Simple, where we make the world of data effortless, relevant, and yes, even fun.
Hello, Making Data Simple listeners. If this is your first time, this is where we talk about data, we talk about trending technologies, business innovation, we talk about leadership. If you've been here before, you know we're going to have some fun. Today's topic, well, we've got a lot in store for you today. We've got AI, we've got data, we got founding tech companies. I've spent a lot of time lately with NLP, which is natural language processing, and startups, and we're probably continuing that trend a little bit. We might even get to a little chat GPT. Hopefully Peter's going to help us out on that. But I have the pleasure of speaking with Peter Voss today with IGO. He is the founder, CEO, and chief scientist of IGO. And he's joining us today. He coined the term artificial general intelligence. For the past 15 years, Voss and his team have been perfecting an industry disruptive, highly intelligent, hyper-personalized chatbot with a brain. And I'm going to steal a little bit from his LinkedIn today. It talks about Peter as a serial entrepreneur, an engineer, an inventor, and a pioneer in artificial intelligence. And I have to say, Peter, I went out to LinkedIn today and, you know, I look at a lot of LinkedIn profiles and I have a lot of guests. On your LinkedIn, the one thing that stuck out was founder. You've been founding a lot. But Peter, welcome to the show. It's going to be a great opportunity to have a chat with you.
Yes, thanks for having me. Maybe it's founder because I'm unemployable, you know?
Speaking of, let's hear from you in terms of your experience. Start way back when, give us some history here, how you got into technology, where you started, and then what brings you to today.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've been around from the beginnings of microcomputers and that. I started actually as an electronics engineer. I started my own company doing electronic designs for industrial applications. Then I fell in love with software and my company turned into a software company. And I actually developed a comprehensive ERP system for small to medium-sized companies so that in those early days, it was still novelty for small companies to be able to have their own computer system. So we would provide the hardware, software, and the complete solution for smallish businesses with maybe 10 workstations or so maximum. And that company was actually quite successful. We went from the garage to 400 people and did an IPO. So that was very exciting. And it's really when I exited that company, I had enough time and money on my hands to say, well, what problem do I want to solve next? And what struck me is that software is actually quite dumb. And, I was very proud of my own software, but still, if the programmer didn't think of something, it would just crash or give you an error, do something unintelligent. So I really started on about 20 odd years ago on this mission of how can we build intelligent software? And I took off 5 years to actually study intelligence, all different aspects, starting with epistemology, theory of knowledge. How do we know anything? How do children learn?
Well, that's it. That is going back a bit.
But yeah. Go ahead. Right. I really wanted to deeply understand, all different aspects of intelligence, and how do we measure intelligence? Are IQ tests meaningful? What aspect of them are meaningful? So in that journey, I got quite a lot of insights and understanding what is important in intelligence, as far as computers go. Obviously, I studied also what had been done in the field of AI up to that point. So after after 5 years of sort of studying, learning, and coming up with my own designs, I started my own AI company. Initially, we were in R&D mode, basically just turning my ideas into different prototypes, experimenting around. And then in 2008, we launched our first commercial product company called Smart Action, basically doing automated calls intelligently. And so Smart Action is still about 80 people company. And I exited that company for various reasons and started what is now called IGO.AI. And we now have the second generation of this technology of conversational AI with a brain. And we can talk about what kind of brain it is. And that's basically, we are now dividing our time between increasing the IQ of our system and commercializing it. So
how many companies have you founded in total?
Well, you know, so some of the companies morphed into others, but probably five or six.
Five or six companies. How many have you essentially IPO'd or sold?
So I only IPO'd the one company, and I've sold about three of the companies over the years. Yeah.
Would you prefer to IPO? Is that your goal? I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about IGO in a second, but is that essentially your goal with IGO, or do you have a different objective?
Yes. And, you know, VCs don't really love us because we tend to be pretty upfront and saying, no, we don't really want to sell our company to, you know, Apple or, you know, Amazon or something. So we, yes, going IPO makes the most sense for us because we really want to continue developing our technology. And typically when you sell a tech company like that, it just goes to die.
So you have a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it that you're not willing to lose, and you feel like you've got a ton of upside.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's really very sad when you see, I mean, you know, Siri, I think they had a lot of ideas on what they would do with Siri when they sold it to Apple. And apparently Steve Jobs, you know, shared those, that enthusiasm. But then once they sold the company to Siri, by all accounts, it just stagnated and, you know, and the founders all left. And, you know, you see that over and over again.
Just for clarity, on the Smart Action Company, you said that was built around automation or automated calls. Could you say more? What do you mean by automated calls?
Yeah, so IVR, interactive voice response. So it's, you know, when you call into a company and most people hate it and they just press zero because the conversational AI is basically just a simple flowchart that, you know, forces you into things. So in Smart Action, we basically have technology with a brain that it, and what I mean by brain is that it has deeper understanding, it keeps context, it has short-term memory, it has long-term memory, it can reason. So you have a much, much better experience. So in Smart Action, we focused on voice interactions. And, you know, just to sort of complete that story, I ended up having investors that really weren't too interested in improving the technology because we were so far ahead of the competition anyway. So it was really more about building out infrastructure and sales and marketing and so on. So that's why I sold that company. I sold my share in the company and then started a new R&D company, which turned into IGO to really take the technology to the next level. And with IGO, so far, up to now, we've been focusing on chat, because chat is becoming, you know, more popular than voice. It has much higher growth. But we actually also just right now in the process of introducing speech as well to our, you know, offering.
I'll jump into IGO just a moment. But why the passion and intelligence? Why are you so profoundly invested, and so much so that you would take 5 years off? Where does it come from?
Well, it's a combination of, on the one hand, I can't think of anything more exciting than actually having intelligent systems. And I mean, the vision I have is that we will ultimately have AIs that can serve as researchers. You know, imagine you train one AI as a cancer researcher, and you can now make 1 million copies of that. So you suddenly have 1 million PhD level researchers chipping away at cancer. And you know, you can take that same scenario in whether you're talking about pollution or, you know, poverty or, you know, whichever problems that we have, you know, ultimately automating intelligence. It's hard to think of something more exciting as a technology. So one side of it, and the other side of it, I actually feel personally I'm really well qualified for doing it. It's sort of the natural thing for me to do because I've long had an interest in philosophy, epistemology, and also psychology, which I think is a very important aspect of understanding intelligence. And I think that's where a lot of AI goes wrong, goes off the wrong track, that it's basically mathematicians and statisticians trying to solve intelligence. But I think you really need to start from understanding cognition. you know, understanding intelligence from a cognition point of view to be able to effectively build it.
The humanities are back, right?
Yeah.
Humanities are back with AI. I'm with you. All right. So IGO. Now, just to give it as a lead in, you've already talked to some of this. You would ask, hey, why is your chatbot failing you? Because it doesn't have a brain. And that's where you introduce IGO. And you advertise it as the world's first and only chatbot with a brain. All right. So talk to me about it. I'd like to understand some of the technology behind it. And as much as you can tell me about the secret sauce here, I mean, why is it so different? Where is it differentiated?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the ways to give a perspective here is DARPA presented a paper a few years ago where they talk about the three waves of AI or the third wave of AI. And what they meant by that is the first wave of AI was good old-fashioned AI. You know, basically logic-based system, expert systems, and so on. And IBM's Deep Blue is a perfect example of that, you know, the world chess champion. That would be sort of first wave of AI. And the second wave of AI is basically statistical systems or neural networks, which hit us like a tsunami about 10 years ago when people really figured out how to get neural networks to do very interesting things. By using massive amounts of data, massive amounts of computing power. And that's kind of the wave we find ourselves in is, you know, statistical neural network type systems. And what they mean by the third wave is our systems that are inherently adaptive, that have understanding and reasoning. And there we're getting into really what AGI means, to have real intelligence, what we expect from an intelligent system. Now, of course, they're not totally hard dividing lines between them. And, you know, each of the systems borrow, you know, waves borrow from the other waves. So there's definitely overlap between those. So, you know, after my research ended, I came to the conclusion that what we need is a cognitive architecture. And that's essentially what the third wave of AI is. You need to start by saying, what does intelligence require? And so it needs knowledge representation, it needs deep understanding, it needs short-term memory, it needs to be able to learn interactively, very, very important. It needs to have context, needs to have a reasoning ability, logical reasoning. So it needs all of those components that work together in an integrated way. And that's really what our secret sauce is, that we've achieved that, where other people who've tried to implement cognitive architectures have not really failed. And I can certainly expand on that.
So, well, while you're there, go ahead and expand. Why are they failing where you're not?
Right. So the reason we are the only chatbot with a brain is a combination of two things, I believe. The one is it's an accident of history. And that is that machine learning, deep learning has been so incredibly successful that it sucked all of the oxygen out of the air. So, you know, you want to do a PhD, it's got to be deep learning, machine learning. You know, you won't get a sponsor if you're trying to do cognitive architectures. You want to get funding, you want to earn big bucks. You know, it's basically, it all centers around deep learning, machine learning over the last 10 years. So that's kind of the accident of history. The other thing is we have come across, you know, we've been talking to labs at Samsung, at Microsoft, at Oracle, and so on. And, you know, people have played around with cognitive architectures. In particular, they've tried to integrate knowledge graphs into their systems, into their conversational AI systems, because that's a key element that you really want. You want a robust knowledge graph that is not opaque. You know, that's not like a deep learning system. So you want a knowledge graph, but it needs to be an integral part of your conversational setup. And what good engineers, what they do is they basically have a very modular system. They say, okay, we need a parser. What's the best parser? Maybe, you know, a few years ago it was the Stanford parser. So we'll use the Stanford parser. We need a reasoning engine. They'll use some reasoning engine. We'll need a knowledge graph. They use some kind of graph database, and they plug these things together. The problem is you have such poor performance. These systems don't talk to each other well. They're not integrated. So our secret sauce, obviously, it's not that secret anymore, seeing I'm going to talk about it, But our secret sauce is that we've developed a knowledge graph technology that is two orders of magnitude faster than any commercially available graph database. And we've developed all of the components ourselves from the ground up, the parsing, the reasoning engine, and so on. And they're all deeply, highly integrated. So as you're parsing a sentence, it has full access to the knowledge graph. It has access to the reasoning engine. And these components all can interact very rapidly to basically get the right intent. It utilizes short-term memory, context, and can also learn on the fly, basically, because of these highly integrated components. And that's basically, the secret sauce that we have. And I don't mind talking about it because, A, I'd love to see truly intelligent systems come about, I'd prefer us being the company that dominates the field. But I'd like to really see truly intelligent systems being available to help us solve the problems that we have. But secondly, it's really, really hard to get this to work properly. And, there's just a lot of knowledge that we've gained over the last 15 years on how to actually get this to work.
Yeah, look, I think in these situations, you've not given anything away because you have to do the work to get to the point where you're at. It's taunting, if anything else. Is it built off of NLP and are you using or leveraging GPT? Like we've had some major releases of ChatGPT, et cetera. And I think everybody is getting on the podcast. The last two, I think, maybe three, have been around ChatGPT or GPT in general and using natural language processing technology, No,
we don't use any of that technology. And we found whenever we've tried to use it, it just gets in the way. I actually just a week ago, when ChatGPT came out, I wrote an article of why ChatGPT is not suitable for commercial applications or at least commercial conversational AI like chat. And there are a whole lot of reasons for that, but the primary reason is you can't rely on its responses, and it makes up stuff. And if you're an enterprise, what your chatbot says to your customer has to be signed off by legal. It has to be signed off by marketing. It has to be signed off by customer experience. Now, you could obviously have a web search or something, but then it's not a conversation you're having. It's just search, it's a search engine on steroids, basically, that you can use. But as long as GPT can make up stuff, the other reason is, and I'll say I have about 6 points it's a short article that I have. The other thing is it needs to be deeply integrated with your APIs. Now, you can't really integrate an opaque language model accurately with APIs, So there are a long list of problems of why it's simply not robust enough and predictable enough for commercial grade conversations.
I must not be the first that have asked you this, though, hence the reason that you wrote the article to begin with. What prompted you to or trigger you to write that article to outline the fact that, hey, it's you can't rely on responses from ChatGPT?
Well, I would say maybe a slight exaggeration, but probably every single one of our investors contacted us. Every single one of our prospects contacted us and say, hey, can't we use ChatGPT for chat? Why do we want to use IGO system? So, there is this overwhelming sense that, wow, this thing is so good, it is. It's incredibly impressive in having conversations and making up stuff and poems. And it is incredibly impressive. So people jump to the conclusion that it can somehow handle industrial grade conversations, that it can replace call center agents. And, that's kind of an obvious conclusion that people jump to. So we had to address it. So I thought, well, I may as well just write it down of why exactly it's not going to fly.
By the way, is that on your website? Because I'd like to take a look.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's linked on our website.
I go to AI.
I go to AI. Yeah, it's under resources. I also have quite a number, probably 36 articles on medium.com. They're also linked from our website about AGI and AI and intelligence and, you know, Google Duplex when it came out. People said, you know, it passes the Turing test, and, you know, now a few years later, nobody's heard of Google Duplex anymore, you know.
I get it. So let me catch the audience up, or I catch myself up. So we've talked about three ways of AI. You know, you start out with logic-based systems. Statistical systems is next. And then you go into inherently adaptive and with understanding and reasoning. And, you know, really get into cognitive architecture. And your case is like a lot of others are failing at it because they're more interested in the ML pieces. That's, you know, like to your example, that's how you get to a doctorate. You go through the ML path or whatnot. But what you really need is an investment and concerted focus on cognitive architectures, you know, around a parser, reasoning engine, et cetera, and on down. And it's just not happening today outside of your company.
Yeah, pretty much. That's pretty much right. I mean, it's it really is that machine learning, deep learning, and now with ChatGPT and GPT in general, it really is sucking all the oxygen out of the air. I mean, you know, for anybody to believe that you need to take a fundamentally different approach, it's just a very hard pill to swallow. And if you don't have a background from, you know, cognitive psychology or cognitive science, you know, to really your starting point is what does intelligence require? And can we get this from a statistical model? You really don't have an argument. You don't have a conversation. So, I think you summarize it the way I feel about it.
Overall architecture, cognitive architecture, if you will, you know, you got to have machine learning, you have statistics and their parsing, your reasoning engine, et cetera. I think the way we drive that home is, particularly as it relates to a chatbot with a brain, give me like a workflow, a use case, you know, and kind of tie that into the technology, if you would. Like customer is calling in maybe to a call center. Maybe that's where you start. Start wherever you want. But think of me as your investor, the guy that comes in and say, hey, why not chatbot GPT?
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And so a use case, I mean, let's take one of our great customers is 1-800-Flowers, a group of companies. You know, they actually 12 different companies. And they're utilizing our system, basically automating all sorts of customer calls. Now, I'll give that as an example, but equally our brain could be applied, our technology could be applied really in any industry. It's quite industry agnostic. So it can be used for internal support, but it can also be used as a personal assistant, for example, talking to a company for diabetes management. You know, having a personal assistant that can help people manage their diabetes. Because the system is hyper-personalized and can be personalized to each individual user automatically as it interacts and learns from the person and learns accurately, you know, what they're about, it can be applied to any of those. But let me go back to 1-800-Flowers and talk through the implementation and kind of what some of the requirements are. So you have customer support, you have order placing, and you want that hyper-personalized. When 1-800-Flowers came to us, they said, we've been wanting to offer a service, a concierge-type service, that knows the customer as well as we knew our customers when we were one store 40 years ago when we started, or however many years ago it was. So with IGO, with a cognitive architecture like that, you, on the one hand, have all of the business rules that the company has. What can you sell to whom, when, you know, all the various constraints, business rules that you have, and what can you change, what can't you change, and so on. Those are embedded into the knowledge graph that we have. So we start with a knowledge graph that has general knowledge, how to hold a conversation, relationships between people, and, you know, about things and people and places and so on. That's the core technology in our knowledge graph that we have. And then we add to that the specific knowledge required for a given application. So we have the product ontologies that I added that, you know, 1-800-Flowers have and across their 12 companies. We have the business rules, and we also have APIs that can give us, you know, real-time information about customers and products. So that is all integrated into the knowledge graph. To answer your question of surely we use some kind of statistical systems, no, we don't. We actually do not. I mean, I'm not saying there isn't any statistics in our system, but we do not train any language models or parsers or intents. We don't do that. We found that they are just not robust enough in a number of ways. First of all, the problem is they are opaque. So if something goes wrong, your only real remedy is to throw more training data at it, to retrain the model, and hope that you don't have catastrophic forgetting. And that's kind of a road to nowhere. You know, when you're trying to get a robust, predictable system going that needs to conform to exactly to business rules and to exact, you know, situations that a customer has. So you know, our parser basically has deep contextual understanding, and it's not a traditional first wave, good old fashioned AI approach. It's more of a fuzzy approach, and what we'd like to call it evidence based. So we accumulate evidence from lots of different points of view. I think the What's in Jeopardy system was sort of somewhere along that line, where, you know, it got evidence from lots of different systems and then decided. Of course, it had a lot of statistical input as well, which we found not to be very useful. So we gather the evidence of what in the current situation, given what we know about the customer, given what was said earlier in the conversation, what is the intent? What is the intent that the customer is expressing right now, and what action should we take, taking into account actions we have already taken, you know, and the customer history and so on and so on. So that's basically how our system works. But
where does the AI actually come in then? I mean, it sounds like you're putting a lot of things together. By the way, we have, IBM Watson Assistant at IBM. This is about you, not about us. And we have an artificial intelligence that essentially understands customers and context to provide, you know, consistent, accurate answers across an application, device, et cetera. But coming back to you, you keep referencing this brain. And I presume the brain is in the graph itself.
Well, it's a graph together with the supporting algorithms that basically do the reasoning, that have the learning mechanisms, the reasoning mechanisms, the understanding mechanisms that you have. They are built on top of the graph and integrated with that graph. So let me give you the contrast, because yes, you know, you're an investor, so why should you invest in Igo and not one of the other exactly. 15,000 chatbots that are out there? Well, first of all, we have replaced, whenever we get a new customer, almost all of them are using existing chatbot technology, and they find it's basically just not good enough. And the reason for that is that what everybody else does with their chatbots and IVRs, they basically use two components. They use an intent categorizer. So where you train a model with a bunch of data and different tagged categories. And so if somebody says blah, 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 weather, then you trigger the weather skill. And if somebody says, I hate Uber, don't ever give me Uber again, then it'll trigger the Uber app. And basically the skill itself is essentially a flowchart. You know, so that is you have some kind of a flowchart designer, and you say, you ask this question, and then you have an, if the answer is this, then do that. If the answer is that, do something else. And this is why people are so frustrated with IVRs and chatbots, is there's no deep understanding. They don't take context into account. They don't have common sense. They don't do reasoning. You are forced essentially down a flow chart with a pre-trained categorizer of intents. And that's basically our competition. And you know, as I say, people are very frustrated with those. And you know, this is why Alexa is essentially being shut down after they spent many tens of billions of dollars. You know, this year they're going to lose $10 billion, and they're cutting Alexa because people aren't using Alexa, because beyond asking for a song and a timer and you know a few tricks, basically, it's not the kind of conversation and relationship that you would hope that an assistant would get. And Siri is sort of in the same mode. You know, it's one shot commands that you give that it hopefully understands, or the system trains you how to say it, that it will do whatever you want it to do. But you know, there is no reasoning, there is no learning, there's no context.
What will iGo solve for me? And I guess just putting you on the spot, what will it not solve today then? I mean, where does it sit? What will you get? What won't you get?
Yeah, I mean, if I talk about commercial conversational AI, you know, chatbots for a company like Flowers or a bank or a Comcast or whatever. So a traditional chat technology, if I had to put on a scale of, you know, 100, I mean, not really IQ, but scale of 100, and conventional chat technology gets you to 15, you know, we're at 35. We're still a long way from human level understanding. There is just such an enormous amount of common sense knowledge that we have as humans, just growing up in the real world, that it's very hard to accumulate that knowledge and to have it in the knowledge graph in a useful way, and to be able to do reasoning about that. I mean, you know, we just know about relationships, about people's, you know, the different events that they have, how things work in the world, and so on. And that is missing. You know, there is and that's one of the reasons why we tackle one domain at a time. So within a 1-800 Flowers, we can teach it about the context of what's involved with those kind of events, that kind of purchase, to a fairly good extent. But you go outside of that and you want to talk about, you know, ball games or celebrities or politics or something, it's going to be completely lost.
But you're, by definition then, you're saying you're 2 times better than Siri. You said you're 35, Siri is 15.
It's a different market. So if you say from a cognitive architecture, absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you wanted to put Siri in a call center, it wouldn't work. You know, so we're talking about essentially the benchmark there would be replacing agents in a call center. And, you know, we can't compete with Alexa or Siri on their terms. You know, they spend, you know, literally tens of billions or 100 billion by now on all the interfaces they have, training all of these hundreds of different intents. But the interfaces and all of the specialized programming has gone in to give you scores and music and whatnot. I mean, we can't compete with that. We, you know, that just takes a lot of money to do, just even to negotiate getting access to that data and getting access to those interfaces. So we clearly cannot compete with that without throwing a lot of money at it. But it's a fundamental architecture, the fundamental ability to learn on the fly, to use context, to reason, to have deep understanding. This is where other conversational AI falls down. They don't have that brain.
I would like to have a debate, but we won't today on what IBM has in terms of Watson customer care, Watson assistant. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you this. Who are your customers? What customers are you targeting? You mentioned it early. Enterprise customers, big customers, small customers?
Yeah, at this stage of a development, our focus is on, large enterprise customers, you know, such as banks and, other financial institutions, medical, just very hard to get traction in medical, you know, just takes forever to get anything done. But those are the kind of applications we're targeting right now. It's purely a business decision of it makes sense for us to be working with enterprise rather than individuals. My ultimate goal and my passion is really something what we call the personal assistant. And it really should be called the personal assistant, but that gets a little bit long. So why I say three different meanings of personal. So you ultimately want this personal assistant that you own. So it's personal in the sense it's yours and it serves your agenda, not some mega corporation's agenda. I mean, right now, you know, if you use Alexa, it's not going to tell you what the specials are at Walmart, and Siri isn't going to tell you about the latest Samsung phone. So you ultimately want a personal assistant that you own serves your agenda. It's a one personal. The second personal is hyper-personalized to you. It learns your preferences, your history, your desires, your goals, what you're doing, you know, like having a very effective personal secretary that would be there. And the third personal is the issue of privacy, that certain things are personal to you, private to you, and you want to decide what you share with whom. So that is ultimately our goal of being able to provide this personal assistant to individuals.
What does an engagement look like? Say we have a listener out there that says, hey, I got to talk to Peter and I got to talk to Igo. I got a potential use case. What does that engagement look like? How long does it take from inception, I mean, that initial call, till you've got something? I'm sure it depends on the use case, of course, but yeah, on average, you got something in production.
Yeah. So we, I mean, obviously working with large enterprise companies, everything takes forever. But leaving that aside, we actually had a customer come to us who developed their own chatbot over many years, and they actually offer this chatbot to other large enterprises for support, for internal support. And, you know, it's they have a very good business, but they hit the wall basically with first and second wave technology. And in fact, he listened to one of the podcasts I did, and they contacted us and said, I think we need this kind of technology to take us to the next level. So he sent us a large set of sentences that they struggle with. And we basically, over 3 days, set up a system to recognize them using, you know, existing brain technology. So we can get a system fully up and running within weeks. We actually, one of the other unique features of our company right now is that we deploy this behind the customer's firewall. So large enterprises tend to love that. We're not a SaaS service, so they don't have to rely on some SaaS technology running here. We deploy it basically as a, you know, Kubernetes cluster in whatever their favorite cloud framework is. And so, you know, they control it. But to set it up, we can do it within weeks. The engagement is really, you know, let's identify what the first use case is or use cases are. And typically we ask for sample conversations that they're currently having, either by phone or by chat, and training material that their agents use. And from that, we have a team of linguists, and we call them cognitive psychologists or AI psychologists. And they then build the ontologies for that, or help our customers build the ontologies required to get the additional knowledge. And we hook up the APIs to their whatever existing databases they have. And that's it.
What is your business case typically? Is it replacing agents with cost savings? Is it augmenting agents in terms of accelerated answers? I mean, what is it?
Yeah, it's typically replacing agents. It can also be that we do part of the conversation, depending on the use case, and that then we will hand over to an agent that we've established. You know, we've verified who the customer is, what the issue is, get all the details together, and then pass it over to an agent with a summary. And in fact, we can also give suggestions of what the agent can say, because we can listen in on the conversation and give prompts to the agent, that, you know, if they have a particular offer or some details to provide, our engine can actually provide that. But with our technology, it's actually a shift in the way you look at automation. Typically, people have looked at automation as second best. You know, containment is sort of a negative term. You know, we want to save money, so we do automation. We force people through an ugly tree, and we hope they somehow don't get to an agent. I mean, that's sort of the typical company business model, which I absolutely hate. But we're turning that on its head, where the automation, if it's done properly, if you have enough intelligence in your conversational AI, you actually end up offering a better service than an agent can. And all the large companies are struggling with their call centers. They're struggling keeping staff. They're struggling with training. They're struggling with capacity. So by automation, you can offer no wait times. You know, what a pleasure. So you talk to your bank and you don't have to wait half an hour to get through to somebody. You don't have to repeat your story because it will remember. Or imagine having a call with your cable provider and your Wi-Fi isn't working. So the suggestion might be to reboot the system or to relocate your receiver or whatever. Okay, you hang up, you do that, you reboot the system, you call back. IGO will remember you. It'll remember the conversation exactly that you had. It won't ask you again, have you tried rebooting your system? You know, it will say, did that work? Or did you move it in the kitchen? Is it working better? So it's like talking to the same agent that you spoke to before, yesterday or last week or last year, and he remembers you exactly. So that's actually a better service than any human can offer.
That's good. Good. Where can folks reach you, Peter and IGO?
Just peter@igo.ai or through our website.
Is there anything that I missed that you wanted to make sure that you address?
Well, you did talk about artificial general intelligence, and that's sort of a topic close to my heart, obviously. And I really just want to tie that back to the third wave of AI, that ultimately we want systems that can think and reason and learn the way humans do. And, you know, whether the large language models can be coerced and tweaked to a way where they can actually, you know, be relied on and robust, and you can interface them with, it's possible. I mean, certainly the way technology is moving there is very, very impressive. So it's really, to me, that is the biggest goal of humanity, is for us to have human level AI that can help us solve the many, many problems that we have. And, you know, it's disease, it's poverty, it's governance. It's a huge problem, you know. And I think having AI that can reason properly, I think that will be a tremendous help to humanity.
You know, that scares a lot of people, though. It doesn't seem to scare you.
Well, I think if I look around at the news and that, I think humans making decisions without AI is more scary to me. I think we need AI to save ourselves from ourselves.
Terminator is going to take over, though, huh?
No, that just makes for a good movie. I think, and I've written about that as well, and I've obviously thought a lot about, you know, AI safety and so on. And it's unfortunate it makes for a good movie story for the AI to be the bad guy. But there's really no particular reason to believe that AI will be bad for us, contrary to, you know, what. But that's a whole nother story. If you have another,
I know that's minutes, another podcast.
half an hour, we could talk about why I believe that the scare stories of AI are largely misplaced, not completely, but largely misplaced.
Well, I do have two questions to finalize the podcast, at least for today. When did you arrive at the definition of artificial general intelligence?
In 2002, I was ready to start building AGI. In fact, I put a team together, but I didn't have the name for it. And I realized that artificial intelligence had really lost its way, in the sense that when the term was coined some 60 odd years ago. It was about building machines that can think and learn and reason the way humans do. But that turned out to be a really, really hard problem. So what happened with AI over the decades, it really became narrow AI, where you're basically solving one problem at a time. You know, it's container optimization, or it's playing chess, or it's, you know, whatever it might be, some medical diagnosis. And it's really the external intelligence, it's the intelligence of the programmer, of the data scientist, that solves the problem by writing the algorithm and tweaking the algorithms a certain way. So I got together with some other people who'd come to the same conclusion that we thought the time was ripe to revisit the original dream of AI, to build thinking machines. And we actually wrote a book. We decided to write a book together. We each contribute a chapter. And three of us got together to come up with a title for the book. It was Ben Goertzel, Shane Legg, and myself. And we tossed around various ideas. And basically, we decided on artificial general intelligence, where G is also the symbol for intelligence and intelligence test, or cognitive psychology. And that kind of fit in quite well. So that's how we came up with the term. Actually, you know, for the last 10 years or so, there's an annual AGI conference still organized by, you know, the sort of initial people who came up with the term.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. I love your passion. I love your passion around these concepts. And I have to tell you, it comes through. I can tell you're doing it because you love it, not because you have to or anything from that nature. And you're doing it for the greater good. You've mentioned it a few times. Hey, last question that I like to ask to add some levity to everything, particularly as we're heading into holiday season, which I wish you a happy holiday. And that is, what do you do for fun?
I'm very much into life extension. So, you know, I've been on calorie restriction diet for the last 20 years to try and live as healthy and as long as I can. And so, power walk and hike and so on. And then I ride motorcycles. Talking about levity. Life also has to be worth living. So, I love fast motorcycles and I have a bunch
of them. What kind of motorcycles are we talking here?
The fastest one I have is a S1000RR BMW, and that does about 185 miles an hour.
How often do you do 185 miles an hour on that?
I only do that on the track. On the, you know, on the freeways, I try and restrain myself to like 150 or so, you know.
No. Yeah, of course.
And then I have a nostalgia bike that's 48 years old. An old BMW R90S. I actually just got that one.
Sounds like you're a BMW guy.
Yeah, I am. I've had probably about 20 of them. At one stage when I was, you know, like late teens, I actually would buy them and fix them up and sell them. And that's how I actually made money to start my first company, is by fixing motorbikes.
Very good. See, it all comes back together. And you got to tell me, you can't just leave me on a calorie restrictive diet. What does that look like?
It's just, you know, eating fewer calories than the average American diet is, and which you know, it's just a lifestyle thing. You know, you basically have to learn that somebody puts a full plate in front of you, like restaurants do, then, you know, when you're full, you push it away. And, you know, that was kind of hard to learn because, you know, I grew up saying you always finish your plate, you know.
Yeah, that's trouble, right? I'm a fast eater. So my mind doesn't catch up until afterwards. That's what my wife says. I got to slow down.
Right. You know, maybe drink more while you're eating. One of the other tricks, I've got two or three articles on calorie restriction as well on the same website, is also to use smaller utensils. You use the smallest fork and spoon that you have. You eat a soup with a very small spoon, you know, it slows down your eating. You also use small plates because then it looks like it's more. You know, if you take a huge plate, you put X food on it, that doesn't look that impressive. So, you know, there are a couple of these sort of psychological tricks that over time you kind of learn, you know, that just to reduce the number of calories, higher more nutritional but lower calorie density food available to replace some of the, you know, high density, low nutrition food.
Well, thank you for being on. I appreciate it. Very interesting. Like I said, I appreciate your passion. We'll get this out in a couple of weeks, probably after Christmas. Folks, we're recording this before Christmas, but thank you for being here, Peter.
Great. Well, thanks for having me. And as you say, I'm still very passionate about this. Couldn't think of doing anything else. So thanks for having me.
Terrific. It's been a pleasure. Listeners, I thank you as well. As always, hit us on almartintalksdata@gmail.com. Look forward to hearing from you. I hope everybody has a happy holidays. I guess by the time you hear this, it may be after Christmas. You never know. If it is, then Happy New Year. There's no limits on Happy New Year. So I'll see you on the other side. Thank you.